This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you one of surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com, where you will find a link to the live chat. The live chat is your go-to way to interact with our listeners or bring up points for discussion on the show. Today we hope to have a fun discussion on a certain type of altruism, but more on that in a second. I'm Ron McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and I'm joined by my handsome co-casters, and I'll let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
Hi guys, this is Eternal.
And this is LDL.
Good evening everybody, this is Roto.
And as I was alluding to earlier, we have a good discussion today. We have a guest who was kind enough to join us, just got signed up and got his mic to pristine quality, and Mr. Edward Miller. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
And why don't you go ahead and introduce us a little bit in your own words to kind of what you're interested in, as I understand it, effective altruism. Again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. So effective altruism is a philosophy that's basically trying to figure out how to actually do good in the world, not just signal to others that you're trying to do good, not just trying to, you know, make yourself feel good about being a good person.
Well, there's the fun in that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, it seems like everybody else, is content with just satisfying a basic sense of being a good person. But, you know, I think it's natural for a lot of, you know, most of humanity, in fact, to strive for more and better conditions. And also, you know, that extends not just to yourself, but to your fellow humans. And if you're going to be donating your time or money or energy to a cause, you might as well be damn sure that what you're doing is achieving the goals you're trying to set for yourself.
Interesting. So essentially, we're faced with the problem that mankind's altruism often is rather self-serving instead of being something that actually helps other people, right? Is that correct?
Oh, exactly. I mean, so there's this guy, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's in libertarian circles, so I thought you might. His name's Robin Hanson. He's kind of a firebrand. But one of the things he loves to do is to say X is not about X. And, you know, what that boils down to is, you know, almost any sort of major human topic that you can think of, you know, has all these, various ideologies or camps associated with it. And, you know, when a lot of people talk about those camps, they talk about more like what are the differences between their objectives, or, you know, the sort of empirical facts about the definitions of those beliefs. Whereas one of the things Robin Hanson likes to do is kind of turn the focus more towards why people are advocating what they're advocating. And he often says that, in fact, it's really for status seeking. You know, you're trying to signal either your intelligence or, you know, what camp you are in. And this status seeking permeates everything from philanthropy to political camps, ideologies.
Did you say philandering?
philanthropy.
So this is what Robin Hanson calls the Homo Hippocrates hypothesis, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's fascinating, the work the man has done, you know, in this sense, and then how he speaks of, you know, forager versus farmer societies and near versus far perspectives. It's amazing. And what you're saying, if I understand correctly, is that, in fact, in reality, most people do most of the things that they do not because of the stated reasons, but because of a reason that is a self-serving reason. And this reason is actually mostly status seeking. It's just, I want to look good. I'm going to help people. Maybe I help people a little bit, but my efforts to help other people would be much more effective in actual terms of helping people if I was more focused on actually doing effective altruism. Is that correct?
Yeah, you got it pretty much. And then basically from there, you can just kind of extend this train of thought to its logical conclusions and just say, all right, you know, what does it mean to be a good person? And a lot of us in the altruist camp are kind of consequentialists. So we say that the goals of, you know, our fundamental values should be to seek a maximum amount of happiness and a minimum amount of suffering. And, you know, a lot of people don't subscribe to that, but that is something that's part and parcel with the whole consequentialist camp, from egoism to utilitarianism to altruism. And the thing about that is, if you're actually trying to do the most good, and you're just walking down the street and somebody's asking for money, you know, a lot of people might say, well, the right thing to do is to give the guy who's asking for money like a few dollars. And what, you know, maybe you're even in a group situation and, you know, you'd look bad actually if you didn't give money in some contexts, or, you know, they're passing a charity pot around at a social gathering, and you know, you're almost obligated for social reasons to give. But what if we told you that for, you know, like a few dollars, we can help eradicate malaria from dozens of children, or, you know, with bed nets, they cost like 20 cents and we can give them out, you know, to families who are severely at risk for diseases that, like malaria, that even if you survive, you are severely, you know, at reduced life expectancy.
And so, actually, a good example of this, I think, is the Susan G. Coleman type donate to breast cancer thing. All the big criticisms you hear there is a lot of the money that is donated actually ends up just kind of funneling back into the organization, not necessarily even to church. And so you're saying something like that would, even though there's sort of the social pressure to participate in a lot of these, especially on college campuses, I mean, there's walks for these things and this sort of relay for life. I'm thinking of that may not be the best time in things of this nature.
You have the right idea, or at least to be skeptical of these claims. Now, in fact, you should also be skeptical of the skeptics, right? So it's actually funny.
We're getting meta now. This is good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the effective altruist sort of pages that we were discussing was a recent claim that, in fact, there's not a good correlation between administrative efficiency and institutional efficiency. And in fact, a lot of the best institutions seem to have a large amount of overhead. So in fact, you know, the typical rankings from Charity Navigator and so on, in fact, there's no real reason to wish to optimize on that level. What you want to optimize for is the goal, not the means. And that's what consequentialists emphasize in general anyways.
That sounded like a good pithy statement. Would you mind repeating that? You said maybe organizational efficiency doesn't necessarily correspond with what?
Well, with the I called it the institutional efficiency. Like, basically, are they meeting their objectives as an institution? What are their objectives? You know, Susan G. Komen, you know, research from breast cancer. Well, let's look at how effective they actually are at achieving the goals they set out for themselves. And
right, right. And then I'm curious too. I guess you mentioned a website. I've heard of that one before, but it's kind of like a market mechanism for people to go on and check to see, is this organization worth donating my money to? Will it go where they say it's going to go, and kind of to that effect? Is that?
Yeah, there's a number of them. One of the biggest ones is Charity Navigator. However, some of the effective altruists have tried to start some alternative organizations that do similar things. So, you know, a lot of them are with an organization called Giving What We Can, and there's one called 80,000 Hours, and there's a number of these where we're all kind of in the same circle of people working towards spreading above all, I would say, an awareness of what effective altruism is all about. And luckily enough, you might have heard of Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide. You know, he donated all of his estate, or most of it, to, I believe it was Giving What We Can, but don't quote me on that. It was one of those.
Very cool. Was that, I could be totally off base, but was that the professional football player with head trauma, or who was this, the benefactor?
Aaron Swartz was the guy, one of the founders of Reddit, and he was under investigation for illegally pirating millions of documents from JSTOR.
One of the founders of Reddit and a pirate. I should definitely know who he is.
Yeah. So he's an interesting fellow, and he also started a number of organizations like Demand Progress and Avaaz, A-V-A-A-Z, and few others that try to facilitate crowdsource campaigns for causes.
He's the guy who hooked up a bunch of stuff to, like, I think computers in closets of MIT or something to get all the articles or something.
Precisely, yeah.
Yeah, and then the state basically wanted to, like, put him in a cage for, I don't know, what, 20, 25 years or something longer than that.
I think it was like 50 years when rapists get like like less than half of that, so it was ridiculous.
The state wanted him gone, and then they accomplished it by having him, you know, commit suicide after terrorizing him for many, many years. And when he killed himself, it's like, oh, but we didn't want him to kill himself. Yes, sure, of course. That's why you threatened him with a cage, right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that was really sad. I'm going to actually go verify. What was the organization you said that you suspected that he gave his estate to? I just want to verify that really quick, so...
We're going to get on the Google machine all the time.
Yeah. I'm actually, there's a bunch of organizations that are effective altruists, and I would just Google effective altruism and Aaron Swartz, and you'll probably run across it real quick.
This is like a CSI episode.
I'm going to sleuth this down. But in the meantime, I wanted to ask a little bit more about some of the different ways you and other effective altruists find to be like the best things to focus on in terms of improving people's livelihood and just improving the quality of life for the most greatest number of people. What are some things that come to mind as just being really, really important overarching things?
Can you repeat the question?
Off the top of your head, some of the things that you think are really important for effective altruists to pursue to improve the lives of as many people as possible. So what are the big picture items?
Right. Well, that's a very big and contentious question. And we do talk about these sorts of things all the time. And on my personal bias is actually not towards philanthropy. And I try to steer a lot of them away from philanthropy because I feel like although I think like they have the right heart and everything they're saying within that the scope of what they're trying to achieve is in fact dead on. Like if I were to want to like donate to philanthropy, I would try to do what they're doing. And within that realm, there's some lesser known areas which I believe deserve extra attention, specifically because the few people who are smart enough, committed enough, and, you know, willing to go against the grain enough to support them, you know, we need every person we can on those issues. And the issues that I really like would be issues like iodine deficiency, which although like probably only affects some millions in Africa, like everyone that like they affect is, you know, it's so so devastating and it's so cheap to rectify that, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah,
so
they started putting iodine in salt, and then in industrialized nations it kind of cured that kind of in like a generation. It was pretty quick, right?
Precisely, but unfortunately you know, there are still some segments of the world that don't have proper iodine, and what it it's known to do is cause between 10% and 15% IQ point loss, which is tremendous. And then also, so they say it's like the number one preventable cause of cretinism, which is a debilitating form of retardation, which, you know, is totally preventable and there's no excuse for it. So another one. Is I would say in vitro meat or cultured meat, where I believe that we must take real seriously animal suffering, and one of the most effective ways I believe to go after that would be to make alternatives to meat that are cheaper, healthier, tastier, and then the market will naturally gravitate towards that.
Interesting. So, to the point that you just raised, the word cretin, which is normally used as an insult, is actually, well, it actually means this debilitating iodine deficiency that causes mental retardation, right? Cretinism. This is why people use the word as an insult, right? And the second thing that you said is, well, I'm a meat eater and I don't much care about animal suffering, but if I could have synthetic meat that was just as tasty as the real deal, I guarantee you I would start buying it right away, because it would be cheaper, it would probably be healthier, it would definitely not require the enormous amounts of feed that cattle need, right? And essentially it would be a net win for everyone.
I see it as win-win completely, and in fact, you could precisely control the exact nutrient contents to the amino acids, so...
I think there's a real danger in this, though. I mean, if you look at the cow, for example, and then compare it to some other animals, part of the reason that the cow, even though it's, you know, not the cutely cat that you're going to take home, is sustained at such large populations is because there's an economic benefit, essentially, in having the cow for the evil purposes.
Cows may die if we switch completely to synthetic meat. Animals like chicken and cows will just die, right? They'll die off because nobody would grow them.
Well,
right?
Yeah, this is what's called the logic from the larder, and you can research that that name. The logic from the larder essentially states what just what you said, that the animals would not exist if it weren't for the demand caused by the meat consumers. But I don't think this argument would hold up by any other possible standard, like, you know, outside of this. So if you think about, for instance, Brave New World, there was these race of people they were creating called Epsilons, who,
through
both, you know,
Volkanovskification, right?
Well, they used scientific techniques in Orwell's Brave New World to create a race of dwarfish, you know, semi-retarded slaves that they could boss around all day. And it's clear that these people, these epsilons, would not exist if it weren't for Brave New World creating them. So,
correct.
You know, so, but, it, you know, it's obvious, I think, to almost any normal human being that this is an immoral act. And in fact, the domesticated cows are very similar. I mean, in fact, that species was scientifically, you know, artificially selected over many generations, and it's far removed from its wild ancestors and could not survive in the wild. And yeah, they can live, they can and should live out the rest of their lives in perfect harmony, but I see no reason to continue creating them for the purpose of slaughter and confinement.
Well, let me take something that I said back. And when I said, you know, chickens and cows would disappear, that's probably not true. They would probably not disappear. They would just be reduced in large amounts of numbers. And of course, if you think that's bad, that's bad. If you think that's good, that's good. I don't particularly care as long as I have meat. And it, of course, the benefit for me would be suffering less meat, like meat without suffering. That's great, right? For me, it's good. And, you know, even if that means that chickens will become pets instead of becoming cattle, like, you know, animals that get raised only for slaughter, I'm fine with that. I don't have a problem with that.
But there's the danger, like, if we have all those animals out there without a purpose, they could group together and rise up, and it could be like Planet of
the Zombie Apocalypse. Yeah, I mean, there's chickens wild in Hawaii. They're pretty much all over the place on golf courses.
I don't think there's a big danger.
Of danger of them going extinct,
so,
yeah.
So are you likewise, somebody from the questions actually asked specifically, couldn't farm animals being used for food, be kept in a zoo for petting or whatever? But that raises another question. Do you find the inherent fine animals to be an equally negative aspect, I guess?
Well, as a utilitarian, and I'm pretty hardcore, like philosophically on that, what I would say is, in fact, no, the confinement is not the issue. What I would say is that the torture that they feel, the suffering that they feel from these circumstances is the problem. Consuming flesh itself is not a problem. Confining, you know, things that move, you know, is not the problem. It's the sort of the ineffable sort of conscious experience that, you know, you cannot, like, I cannot describe to you what suffering is. You'd have to really feel it. I could never explain to a robot what it means to suffer. And this feeling is the is disutility. It incarnate. You know, it is what we're seeking to eradicate from the universe. And that feeling, you know, doesn't exist. For instance, if you had even if you had full animals, they talk about, like, what if you had a factory farm where you grew animals that didn't have brains or didn't have heads, and it was a full beast, but without the brain? That sort of scenario, by a utilitarian account, in many cases would not be considered a net negative.
So that's really interesting. I always wondered, you know, when it comes to you know, animals in nature, you know, animals suffer a lot, which is, you know, nature is cruel. Nature is extremely brutish. Carnivores kill, you know, thousands, millions of animals every year. Would it be, you know, a positive thing to have a more managed kind of, you know, basically like a large zoo or something where you animals are protected from that kind of predatory end?
This gets into some of the heavy debates between various groups, and you know, anything I say will make people mad, so I'll just say what I believe anyways, right? So, but
that's a good policy. that's pretty much what we do 24/7, so by all means.
The non-controversial radio station.
But there's two camps of animal rights people, or animal people. There's animal rights and animal welfare. I support animal welfare, and animal rights essentially says that animals have, like, natural rights that need to be respected. They need to be given autonomy and freedom. They need to, so, like, on that confinement question, like, if you ask them, well, is confinement itself the issue? They would absolutely say yes. And I don't agree with that. The welfare people say our duty to animals is more like that of a steward, or like a, like caring for the sick, or caring for the mentally handicapped, caring for the disabled, caring for people who, you know, who don't have all the material abundance that we have. And, you know, if you consider that perspective for a second and think of yourself in a position of responsibility, given your enormous power as a thinking, you know, intelligent human, then, you know, you feel, I believe, an obligation to help. And that obligation is dangerous, as all the libertarians like to note, and rightly so. So, you know, the fatal conceit and all of that certainly applies to everything that utilitarians talk about.
What is a fatal conceit? I have never heard of this.
Hayek. And it's from Adam Smith, too. It's like I guess I would say the arrogance that comes from wanting to shape the people and the society around you in a micromanaging fashion, and to ignore the autonomous nature of the intelligent beings that surround you, that they can make their own decisions and probably know better what's best for their life than you do. That's the fatal conceit. However,
sounds like the statist conceit.
Yeah, well, basically, you're right. That would be a good synonym. But we're not in that same position with animals. Animals are not rational actors in an Adam Smithian or Hayekian fashion. And the duty we have to animals is much different than the duty we have to rational actors. And it is my personal belief that in dealing with nature, we should be agnostic to where suffering is emanating from and merely seek to ameliorate it, regardless of its source. So, for instance, the casualties and the fatalities from an earthquake or from a tsunami or a hurricane, whether they're animal, are just as deserving of help. And, whether it's, predation or starvation or freezing to death in the wild, all of these should be of moral concern. That doesn't mean every one of them is of equal moral concern. That doesn't mean we necessarily have the capacity at any given time to micromanage nature. But I think it is our duty to ensure, at least in the long run, that we're headed in a direction where we'll have the capacity to do that. And I don't know if you're aware of the more radical transhumanist notions of like a Kardashev scale one civilization, but that would be the type of civilization that would be able to account for these things.
And I think that's the civilization that uses
fuzz.
All the
civilization uses fuzz in their microphones.
Be right back. We'll fix this audio real quick.
It's kind of a running joke, Edward. Sorry, he'll be back in a second. His mic acts up, and we don't know why, and we just give him shit about it every single time.
When our civilization gets to k=1, that's when the fuzz in Eternal's mic will go away. So,
a phase one civilization is one that is able to essentially have the power to govern its own, I don't know, I'm trying to draw on what my brother has told me here. It basically is able to move out into the solar system is one of the major things, I believe, right?
In fact, the way that they calculate it is by, planetary or astronomical bodies. So like phase one would be when you are able to make use of the resources of your host planet completely. Phase two would be the solar system. Phase three would be the galaxy. Phase four would be the universe.
Phase five is question, and phase six is underpants.
Profit, right?
Profit, of course.
Yeah. Oh, right, yeah, phase zero is underpants. So,
interestingly, you've mentioned that there's two different utilitarian camps in the animals in animal protection.
Well, I should rephrase that. The animal rights people are not utilitarian at all.
They're deontologists, right?
Exactly.
Well, I'm a deontologist and I'm not a utilitarian, but I am not in favor of animal rights. Though I, of course, consider it preferable, like highly preferable, not an obligation or anything, but highly preferable to reduce animal suffering. It's not one of my life's priorities because right now one of my life's priorities is to, be prepared for any adverse circumstance and have, like a nest egg that then I can rely on. So that's one of my first priorities. But if I could help reduce animal suffering, I will do it.
So he actually raises an interesting point, actually. So in terms of this effect of altruism, I mean, how does this correlate to, I guess, a person's specific needs? I mean, let's say Rutto's entire nest egg, then is it effectively then he should be worrying about this? Or is this a concern that altruists take into account, I guess?
Utilitarianism, properly considered, I don't believe falls into any of the sort of misconceptions that most people have about it, because it's actually pretty hilarious in that a lot of the arguments against utilitarianism are explicitly consequentialist. They say, oh, if you give away all your money, then where will it be? Or like, there's actually a lot of funny things that you could say about it. Like, if everyone were 100% altruist, then everyone would want to give away all their money to everybody else, but nobody would take it. Like a lot of weird sort of paradoxes, but they're not actually paradox is when you actually understand what it means to be a consequentialist, then that means that you care about the consequences of your actions. And that implies on the largest possible scale that you can consider as a rational actor. You know, you are obviously not God. You cannot know everything that, you know, all the chains of cause and effect in the universe, and the law of unintended consequences always applies. In fact, it always applies to everything you do in your personal life as well. So you can't know that your investment that you made today won't, in fact, you know, be the worst investment of all time. But what you do know is that, you know, that there's probabilities in the world, and expected utility is what you are going after, whether you're a self-interested person or a utilitarian. And
well, Bitcoin can't be that bad, right?
Well, if you invested a few years ago, it'd be really great.
We made it 32 minutes before talking about Bitcoin, Roto. That's like a new record. That's pretty good.
Yeah,
that is good.
Yeah. The idea is if you're thinking rationally about the holistic, you know, outcomes of your actions, you will have to consider almost all of these sorts of factors. Like, in fact, whether you are personally harming your own ability to continue helping the world. That's an altruistic reason to help yourself. Now, there's, in fact, articles by a friend of mine named Brian, who he argues strongly that one of the ways you should personally implement effective altruism in your life is to actually make as much money as you possibly can. Now,
he's right.
Now, you know, the way he would say, though, is that you don't make it, if you're trying to be an effective altruist and not, you know, just an effective egoist, your goals are different, but your means, I guess, are similar. But what you do is, you make as much money as you can, but you don't just hoard it up in a big pile or even make investments, because almost, because apparently if you do the math on the effective altruist causes, you know, there's no possible investment that on a regular basis can give you the returns, the expected utility of just doing it immediately, of just giving it immediately. But you of course need to, you know, have enough for yourself. What you need to do, we say, is do self-binding, because there's this thing called akrasia, which means you cannot trust yourself to be to live up to your own motivations. So you create
External motivations, right?
Well, not only that, even like contractually binding things that will, like, you know, you set up a deal with your employer to pay into a trust, and you get money from the trust, but the rest of the trust money goes to the causes that you'd specified.
Yeah, BMinder does that to you. Like, for people who don't have money for trusts, BMinder would do about the same thing. I have a question for you. The question is actually rather simple. I consider that starting a business and working hard and hiring people and inventing or progressing mankind in the process of doing these things is a form of effective altruism. What do you think?
I think that everyday individuals in the scope of their daily lives are of net positive benefit to the world. I, as a utilitarian, believe that everybody basically is obligated to try to maximize utility, but in fact, I don't believe that there should be any legal obligation or social or extreme social ostracism for those who don't. I think that, you know, normal individuals are just great, and in fact, unlike a lot of people, I think we actually should encourage, you know, more what they call growth, you know, economic population, everything.
So, as voluntarists, the big thing that we hold to is that generally, when you introduce an entity that forces people to be altruistic or you know, tries to force everybody to. So when you have the state that comes in, for instance, and it comes in and forces people to. Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, a mafia or you know, any criminal organization or something like that. I'm really painting the state pretty good here, right? So, when you have an organization that uses force to accomplish these ends, it creates secondary effects some of which are, you know, pretty perverse incentives. And if you do some reading up on political economy, especially the Oshawa Virginian School of Political Economy, you understand that you create these weird effects where, you know, when you're spending other people's money, you don't do as good a job of picking good uses for it and things like that. So when you treat everybody
as hookers are not good use. Hookers are a good use.
And blow. Don't forget blow.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, when you have a system like a government that is spending other people's money for them, you get these perverse incentives that reduce the overall net economic benefit for everybody. So I would say from a utilitarian perspective, there's a lot of libertarians like David Friedman that argue this. You
know, not just him, but Mises and Hayek and Milton Friedman as well.
Yeah, all those guys, they all make the argument from economic efficiency that you really can't have a state if you want to maximize utility, as it were, whatever measure you try to ascribe to that utility.
Well, I don't know that all of those guys, David Friedman, yeah, but the rest of them that don't take an anti-statist position in that sense. But yes, they do support the laissez-faire approach, and that's something that I generally share. And I'm very supportive of various. I guess the Austrian worldview in general is something I support, maybe 75%, something like that. I have some differences, but I do see what you mean. And the idea of a state mandating from the top down how best to allocate resources, yeah, from a purely empirical perspective, I think doesn't hold up, and utilitarians are very much wanting to use the empirical method to judge between systems, and it's clear that the micromanaging bureaucratic approach just comes in, if not dead last, right around there, and the approach that I use is just to sort of be a little bit risk averse in that, and I say that, all right, you know, the expected utility of a dictator who was really benevolent might be X, but the expected disutility is Y, and then, you know, the percent chance that it'll actually happen that you get the good dictator is like vanishingly small, and the percent chance that you get the bad one is pretty probable. Now there's science fiction that kind of addresses some of this, where in fact some of the assumptions then are undermined in that model. So for instance, there's this science fiction series called The Culture Series, the author of which, Ian Banks, just passed away. But he argues that his utopian future would be one in which you have these great minds, he calls them, like artificial intelligences that govern action. And it's sort of in one way it's very libertarian, but in another way it's obviously ruled by these sovereign AIs, and so they let you basically do whatever you want, but they are very watchful.
And, very zeitgeisty, it sounds like.
Yeah. So, you know, in theory, right? So, like, I guess what I'm hinting at is that in practice, I think I side with you guys. I guess in theory, I'm more consequentialist, but I guess that's also true of Milton Friedman and Hayek and Mises and David Friedman. So, it's not uncommon to be a utilitarian, but it's not common, I guess, to admit that under circumstances, in theory, it might be possible to conceive of an AI. In fact, that's what the transhumanists talk about all the time, even though they're like libertarians, they want their AI gods too. But it's like, I'm not very hopeful like they are that they'll happen, but, you know, I wouldn't categorically just dismiss it as a, you know, bad idea on principle, maybe for other reasons.
I just don't really like the idea of sitting around and having an intellectual circle jerk over something that has about as much likelihood as, you know, Vulcans descending from the sky and blessing us with their grace and welcoming us into the Federation or something like that. I don't watch enough Star Trek. Actually, I watch way too much Star Trek. I wanted to, before you chime in, Ron, I wanted to make, you know, the other point, which is that when you have a government which by definition uses force, uses, you know, men in blue costumes to run around with firearms and point them in your general direction if you
to
don't
give me a speeding
decrees.
Ticket last night.
Fuck yeah, it. That was unfortunate.
I'm not bitter at all, but yeah, sorry to interrupt. I get a little bit of state rage every once in a while today.
We'll let you get that out in a couple minutes here. I'll let you just scream for like the last 10 minutes of the show.
Okay. Yeah, please go on with your point.
Yeah. So as I was saying, when you have a government coming in and forcing people to do things, what would be, I guess, considered altruism, I think becomes something different. I don't think it really is altruistic to have a bunch of people go around and say, pay up so we can give your money to these people that I declare to be in need of it. And I think that kind of either delegitimizes or just kind of kicks. It seems to run counter to the whole idea of having people be better people and be more altruistic in their own lives. So
the way I would respond is first that I think that the reasons why we have governments is rooted in human nature and all of those bad Darwinian things that we were talking about at the beginning about us being status seeking and self-interested and so on, you know, but there's much worse than that, you could say self-interest could be a good thing, but the bad aspects of human nature are not something that we can just shield our eyes to, in my opinion, right? I'm not supporting any cause or by saying that. I'm just saying that when we think about governments and states, we just need to tie it directly back into what we know about biology and about the history of all of humanity. And we know that it's been a violent, brutal thing, just like nature, we said, was violent and brutal. And the idea that, you know, we can have a society without states is a wonderful idea. In fact, I think it relies on a different type of being, a different type of species to carry it out. And when you start going into that realm, it almost doesn't even matter what the system is anymore. I mean, if you had a race of benevolent angels, they could work just fine under fascism as anarchism, and it wouldn't even matter because everyone would just be loving and wonderful towards each other. The other thing I would also say is a lot of the assumptions about what aggression and property are not well founded by Austrian presumptions. And I know that's another ball of hay there, but whatever.
So when you mentioned that the existence of the state as an institution can be tied to our own biological imperatives, our own biological realities, I would like to agree with that with a caveat. And the caveat is as follows. So we are animals. Humans are animals. Like every animal, we respond to certain incentives, to certain stimuli. If we experience in our lifetimes stimuli that lead us to conclude that it is right and good and righteous and moral to have an exceptional magical group of people that have the ability and the right and the entitlement and the obligation to initiate violence against everyone else, then we will conclude that's fine and good. Just like when we were in the state of societies having slavery everywhere, we've experienced that those stimuli led people to believe that society and slavery were hand in hand, that you couldn't do any other way, right? And well, as it happens, everyone experiences the stimulus of having someone with overwhelming violence tell you what to do, and if you don't like it, punish you violently. Most people experience it in their lifetimes because their parents treat people like crap for the most part. So if in your house you are told that you must obey whatever you're told or else they'll beat you up or they'll yell at you or they'll neglect you, you will grow up as an animal conditioned for to other people doing that to you and saying, yeah, this is how the world is supposed to be because this is everything I knew, right? It's like asking a fish, hey, how about the water? The fish is not going to tell you anything because the fish can't see the water. Fish is in the water, right? Whereas with proper parenting and no magical exceptions of any kind for any superstitions or any magical groups of people, and children growing up in that way, then the other part of mankind, that is to say the altruistic, the noble, the peaceful part of mankind, is what actually emerges. And you can see this in well-raised children, right? They're not violent. They don't accept violence. They're completely baffled when an entity like a state or like a mafia is violent against them. They recognize this violence as something that they have not lived and they don't agree to. And this is where we're going to when we say we're voluntarists and we try to make the world a better place in this manner, where as we have abolished treating women like chattel, and we have abolished treating gay people like animals, and we have abolished treating black people like beasts of burden, and we are in the process, right now, in the process of abolishing the treatment of children like objects to be done whatever the parents want with their children, or whatever other institutions want with the children. We're abolishing that. Only when that has happened can we say, yes, the origin of mankind has changed from a group of people that use violence against those who can't defend themselves to a group of people who avoids the use of violence except in self-defense. What do you think about that?
I think that is a very noble and beautiful but false answer to everything. So the idea that people will, through proper parenting or a proper environment, overcome the tyranny of their genes is, you know, mistaken. It's wishful thinking. Now, you know, it's sort of like if a lion is running up to come bite your head off, you don't sit down with it and, you know, try to reason with it. You know, they're not able to be domesticated. There's just nothing you can do. And they are robots programmed to bite your head off. And that's just how they are. And
I'm not so sure that's true for, I mean, I can tell you that there's absolutely something about our humanity that cannot be denied through parenting or through racing or whatever it is, right? I'm not sure violence is one of those things.
Well, yeah, I think it's reasonable to believe that there's a lot of room for environmental, molding of individuals. I don't believe, however, that we are entirely at the mercy of our environment. I believe strongly that genetic influences can empirically be demonstrated to be shown in relation to violence or in relation to almost any other human trait that you wanna think about, even altruism. And in fact, that's something that a lot of us altruists talk about, how to cultivate altruism in our species. And, you know, there's a lot of ways you could go about doing that. And you know, we as biological beings,
Let me agree with you for a second. I want to agree with you when you're saying that we can't escape the cage of genes. It's not possible. I, however, have evidence to believe, I've seen evidence to believe that even in the cases of sociopathy, parenting plays a big role on whether the sociopathy, which is a genetic tendency but not a genetic sentence, happens or not. So that's, I mean, to me, it's fascinating to see that people who are malevolent, people who, you know, until a couple of years ago, we just thought they were just malevolent because they were born malevolent. Turns out it's not true. It's epigenetics, right? I believe Eternal has got a point to make. I'm not sure if it dovetails with this one.
I can't remember. Was it James Fallon? Was that the guy who was, this is the guy who was posted, I guess he was a neuropsychologist, I think?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, that's what it is. And he had something that was posted on our Reddit board, our anarcho-capitalism, a while back, and he was talking about the effects of epigenetics on violence in human beings, and it was really fascinating stuff. He talked about how there's, like, the perfect storm of conditions. You need to have, like, the genetic predisposition plus, like, the crappy childhood to do it, and that creates what we would call the violent psychopath in society. So this would be the person you're talking about, I assume, is a person that is just so violent that, you know, nobody is really going to be able to convince this guy. It's just someone who's broken by design.
I totally respect that epigenetics play a huge role. Although it's interesting that, like, the epigenetics, you know, are based on genes. Like, if you don't even have the core genetic, you know, the architecture that would, you know, respond to a catastrophic situation in a psychopathic way, then it'll just never happen. Now,
agreed.
So,
yeah.
So then, and then furthermore, I think you can actually find plenty of evidence of very well raised, you know, middle class, respectable people that just go out and do awful things. And furthermore, what we talked about earlier about nature being brutal, you know, just, you know, even if you're devastated by a natural cause, not even another human, you know, even if everybody on Earth were raised perfectly, and one of those people with the bad genes gets, you know, into some calamity that's natural but not human caused, you know, it could still activate, you know, these.
I've never seen a person who was middle class and well raised that went on to become a murderer or a rapist. Almost every single one of them that I know of have experienced some kind of child abuse or neglect.
Jeffrey Dahmer and a lot of people seem to have come from very normal backgrounds. But the
yeah, Reto, you don't watch enough HBO documentaries.
Usually the parents just say something like, no, but we raised him okay. It's not because, of course, they're trying to minimize their own
blame. But it's not just that. Barack Obama, here, the perfectly normal childhood, you know, went to Harvard and, you know, you probably don't like these drone bombing people, but he seems okay with it. So, you know, I just don't really.
Yeah, but he got us a phone.
Yeah, they bomb a phone. Yeah, one of the things also, I believe, is the economics drive a lot of crime and poverty, and the poverty exacerbates the crime, and it's like this vicious cycle. And I fundamentally disagree with a lot of almost all economic theories, because very few of them recognize some core classical liberal principles that have been ignored throughout the years. And there's a very nice chapter in Herbert Spencer's Social Statics where he talks about the rights to the use of the earth. And he says that, landowners have the sovereign right over their, piece of the earth, and all landowners likewise have this capacity. And if the natural extension of this system is all of Earth becomes under ownership, then all who are not landowners are completely at the mercy of landowners, and they are like trespassers on the Earth. So, and this fundamental freedom, this fundamental right that they've been excluded from, is one of the key drivers of poverty, and one of those exacerbating tendencies that drives crime and violence and nihilism and despair and suffering.
I just wanted to mention really quick, I think a lot of what that stems from is the enclosure movement in the 1800s in Europe, whereby all the nobility drove the peasants off the land into the cities, into the factories, and they basically claimed all the land for themselves, and it created that situation, which gave rise to what we would call geolibertarianism or Georgism, which is, I guess, what you were referring to.
That's exactly right. But indeed, even Rothbard and Man, Economy, and State, his model that he puts forth would lead to that exact same situation that Spencer was warning us about. And what he said is that through mixing your labor with the soil, that you indeed become a sovereign owner in perpetuity, regardless of whether you continue to use your land or not, and that your heirs can inherit it forever.
I think, you know, so yeah, this is a part where a lot of, there was a lot of the hosts of this show and a lot of voluntarists or anarcho-capitalists today seem to disagree with Rothbard, which is, we don't like to talk about, you know, that kind of Adam Smith idea of, okay, I homesteaded it, therefore now I'm king forever. It's rather you have to keep using it, and there's property rights seem to be a little more dynamic and allow for abandonment and various other things. So it's something that I think we're trying to solve, and trying to mesh the, you know, pureness of anarcho-capitalism with the understanding that can be a real problem from the Georgist sense. Now, my hope is that
empirically, if you created a system where it worked out, I'd be on board. So I'm not ideological about it, but it just seems to me very obvious that you as a material entity have certain requirements among these space and, you know, water and air and things like that. And if somebody bottled all the air, you'd be completely at their mercy. Like, how much could they charge you for the air? It's like, how much do you got? You know, and that sort of power disparity, in fact, exists in many circumstances, but it exists, you know, like when we libertarians talk about markups, monopoly markups. You know, if somebody has a monopoly over the entire worldwide industry of staplers, the markup that they can possibly charge is going to be limited because there's a lot of alternatives to using staplers. But if somebody owns, you know, if you are in requiring land, you know, and all the land is owned, you know, the market price for land will be set based on more or less your ability to pay. Altruism on the part of landowners could in theory reduce it, but if you make the assumption that they're self-interested, they're going to try to maximize their profit.
There's also a topic in here that isn't often brought up, which is that a lot of times critics of libertarianism will negative externalities and this sort of thing to, you know, if you dump your chemicals into the lake, da 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 da. But one of the things that doesn't seem to be brought up.
Do you mind if I actually, like, I would love to have this conversation continue, but we are really, really low on time right now,
yep.
So.
Seeing that, go for it.
Yeah, so I wanted to, we had a couple quick questions that we wanted to get, like, some one-minute answers out of you before we run out of time here, Edward. And it's a shame, because I want to continue this discussion as long as we can, so, Ron, you wanted to ask a quick question, so I'll let you go really quick.
Yeah, let's get in there with a listener question. We've been had it ready for a little while, but we've been going strong. So Quash brought up, and it sounds like a pretty kind of obvious question from the start, but it might have some more profound kind of results or to it. But why altruism, essentially? He said, you know, why do altruistic acts? What's your thought?
In my experience, the greatest joys come from helping others. I believe this is also empirically shown to be true, that people who help others are more satisfied with their life, report higher levels of sanity.
Yes.
And every sort of possible
Absolutely.
Metric, and they are more highly regarded by their peers, and it promotes a kind of intangible level of what you might call social capital or trust that filters through society and in economic terms lowers transaction costs, but in non-economic terms just sort of makes life a more pleasant place. And in fact, if you look deeply enough, I think you'll find that altruism forms the core of civilization, and without it, really, civilization couldn't happen, because cooperation among individuals is the bedrock of civil society. It's the bedrock of the family structure. It's the bedrock of, you know, every like noble pursuit and every amount of art that's worth its weight, and, you know, everything that makes life worth living. And if you don't feel that, then I can't help you.
Also feels good to help other people.
I think that's what he said first.
You got it.
Yeah, I have one more question for you. We like to do this at the very end. I know we're a little bit over time, but I still want to fit this in because it's so good. Yeah, so at the end, we like to ask our guests to go into a bizarre world and argue from the core, from your heart, against the position you hold dear. So what's the best argument you can come from, you can conjure up against the effect of altruism? Go.
Altruism forms the basis of almost all forms of tyranny, because in fact the most noblest aspects of human nature are always those preyed upon by the most tyrannical and horrible people, because in fact those heartstrings are not based on rationality, and it's easiest to manipulate those aspects through fear and through pulling on your benevolent traits.
Man, you didn't miss a beat with that. That was great. I'm convinced.
So, yeah, Ron, you want to take us out here?
Yeah, because we're just pressed on time. Let's take it out. So it's a little bit after 2300 hours Eastern Standard Time and 2000 Pacific. I want to thank Edward Miller again for being our very well-spoken and friendly guest. And lastly, I want to, you know, add in, this has kind of been said tonight by him and other people, but doing things for other people, helping other people, even if there's not a discernible self-benefit in sight, will generally make you feel better. So we would like to encourage you to give it a try. And on top of that, keep Obama and president, you know, he gave us a phone. He's gonna altruism. You too can choose to decline to state as we continue to feel all the feels on either declinefm.com or decline to state on iTunes. I would like to remind you that decline to state is still brought to you free of charge, as well as paid advertisement free. We hope to soon have a Bitcoin donation link up and running for those interested in helping to keep the servers running, the website developing, and the show going.
And the booze flowing.
And booze flowing. A big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, our listeners, people drinking, and of course, Edward Miller for joining us. Decline to State is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. Remember, when asked, always decline to State. This is Ron McPaul saying good night, everybody.
This is Eternal saying have a great night.
This is LDL saying happy altruistic Indiana.
This is Roto, and I had a great time tonight. Edward, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
Oh, sorry to interrupt you. And potentially stay tuned after the outro music. Edward's going to check his schedule and see if he has time to join us for a little after show, a.k.a. drinking time. We'll be right back.